Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
I do think, Grace, as well, like, the pod is so much better when we're drunk.
It is. It's, the vibe is correct. It's more, yeah. People should do podcasts drunk. We say silly and outrageous things sometimes, but
I think Are you guys still in magazine, in the magazine world?
Yeah. Yeah. Clawing along.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, amazing. Fellow writers. I didn't realize that you guys were also writers in your own right. That's amazing. Do you guys have books? I want a copy of your book.
No, we need to release a book. We should do a book where each of us writes like a page each, but we don't look at it or something. No, I don't know. Writing a book, honestly, Caroline, like, petrifies the shit out of me. Like, I'm so in awe of you for always having that in your brain and always just knowing that that was something you wanted to do. Like, I bet you feel the same, Grace. I'm just like, I couldn't imagine.
And to actually do it, like, it is such an undertaking. Like, as someone who's at the moment trying to get in that, like, creative mindset and just put shit on paper, you have to overcome so much, like, self-loathing, realizing that there's this huge gap between what you know good writing to be and what you're writing. Like, there's this massive psychological barrier to get to the point where you've written a book.
Totally. I have this line in Scammer, something like, you know, I put off writing books my whole life, or I avoided writing books my whole life by avoiding first drafts. Like, I couldn't tolerate my own mediocrity. And it's just, first drafts are so bad that they're actually demoralizing. Like, you know, like, your first draft is actually so shitty sometimes, it makes you want to just give up and not keep going. And the best advice I could give any other aspiring creatives out there is advice that my favorite writing professor actually gave me and that I include in the book. He says, be your own crappy little elf. Like, pretend that you're just you're a crappy little elf making crappy little things, and just make a crappy little thing and just leave it there for yourself to find tomorrow and to fix. And that really helped a lot, thinking about it in those terms. And the second piece of advice I would have for anyone really struggling with, like, not just writer's block, but like writer's paralysis, is to just get angry. Like, I feel like Natalie has tried to sell me out, has successfully sold me, or to varying degrees of success, sold me out 3 times in my life. But I've only ever got angry the third time, this last time. The first time was obviously when she sold that piece to The Cut. And I don't know if you've ever had any experience with addiction. You're like, we're clearly alcoholics. Were you not listening, Caroline? But if you have any other experience with addiction that you've actually overcome, unlike the alcoholism, which is the era we're currently living through. But no, it's okay. I drink like 6 days a week, no joke. But I felt a lot of shame about how I had acted in my early 20s and how I'd been the person I'd just been during my Adderall addiction. Like, look at how peppy I am, stone cold sober. Like, no one wanted to be around meth me. Like, I did not need meth. So when she sold me out to the cut, in a strange way, I felt like, okay, now we're even. And not just even, but like, now you've done something even, like, you're taking credit for my work. Like, you're making me, like, you're publicly humiliating me. Like, this is so much worse than like just being a shitty friend in your early 20s. Like, in a weird way, I felt like we were even and we were done. And then the second time, but I wasn't angry. And the second time she tried to sell me out was 2 days later, when she really tried to use the news of my father's suicide to like console me about him, but then like offer her friendship and $15,000 if I would just sign over my life rights to her. And I feel like she really tried to take advantage of my grief to strike a business deal. But again, I wasn't angry because I was just really fucking sad. Like, I was just bereaved. I wasn't pissed at all. But this past winter, a friend who's in publishing in New York leaked a copy of her book proposal, like the document that she used to sell her book.
That's so iconic.
And it was just all about me. It was like how she was going to write an essay about my addiction, how she was going to expand the cut essay. And I just got so fucking pissed. And I just like, I was totally felt like crippled by my own anxiety about writing. And especially because I'd been at a certain point, I really shot myself in the foot by saying that I was going to write a book. And then I felt like I had all this weight of expectation on me from the public. And so many people believed I'd never do it. And finally, I just got sick to fucking death enough of being used by her that I got angry, and that propelled me into action. And so my other piece of advice, beyond being your own crappy little elf to get through those shitty first drafts, is to just let yourself be angry. I think anger plus purpose can be incredibly constructive and like a very useful emotion. I don't think anger always has to be a negative, destructive thing. I think if you apply it towards a goal, it can be a really beautiful feeling to feel.
It's interesting you say that, because we loved the book, by the way. We haven't said that yet. We both read it. It's so beautifully so written. Like,
should I do a quick intro or not? Want to do this? Well, I don't know.
Let's do the intro at the end.
There's no point in really doing an intro.
How do you think you're gonna? How many of those tequila sodas you've had already? But like, I don't know how you're gonna edit. Okay, go for it. I mean, I want to hear the intro.
We'll do it now. It would never be edited to the start. But I was just basically going to say to everyone listening, I guess, obviously, if people are listening to this episode, they'll know who you are. So many of our followers, I already know, fucking love you. We have such a crossover in, I think, in our energies and in our intentions. Like, someone wrote on your Instagrams,
your intention being chaos.
Yes, they were just like a win for all the chaotic but well-intentioned women out there when you release Scammer. And I was like, that's us. It took us 4 years to release merch, and then we like accidentally scammed the girls because we didn't know how to post it to Australia, and it was arriving like 7 months later.
I hate it when you accidentally scam the girls. That's the worst.
I know. And they, but
when you accidentally grift the girls, that's the worst. I hate it when that happens.
They were just like, hey, it's been like 7 months, I've seen everyone else with their hats, but just wondering, is mine still coming? And I was like, oh,
I don't want to be annoying, sorry.
That's so sweet. You know, so many of my fans, I originally sold the book back in 2020 for $25, and lots of people asked for refunds and like no hard feelings. There was a goddamn pandemic. Like, some people got laid off and like genuinely needed that $25 back, so I gave it to them. But for all the girls who I accidentally grifted out there, I automatically upgraded their $25 book order to the $65 luxury first edition. And these books cost like more than $25 to make. So it's like, in a strange way, I'm paying them like about like $3 or $4 a person to own the book.
We were like, we were doing that too. It was costing us like more money. We got the stuff. We got the stuff sent to the UK and then had to personally ourselves ship it to Australia. And shipping it to Australia was like $30 a package.
It's $30. It's $30. Oh my god, literally. And oh my god, my Australian girlies are my biggest scammers, because recently I needed to save up 60 grand to like print the books myself in this like luxury first edition nice way, and like even 20 grand of that 60 grand was going towards like Italian like handcrafted paper. And anyway, the point is that I wasn't, in order to get that 60 grand, I was selling tarot cards, which was like my version of a tarot card reading. I basically like wrote out definitions for like all the tarot cards and then drew them randomly, but I offered free shipping. It was just like a $15 flat rate. Those Australian girlies made a bag in terms of like all their orders and how much I had. Like, I was like, basically like, it's not $15 to send a card to Australia, but like, it's definitely $2 or $3. So it wasn't like the same, you know, 40 cents that I was spending on all the, anyways, Australian scammers out there, I love you so much. You guys are the only ones allowed to scam the scammer. And I'm, you apologize for the times when I have scammed you. Actually, I take that part back. You've really only scammed me, and I really be expecting an apology at your earliest convenience.
They can Venmo you. We'll drop it in the bio.
I literally just spit out my drink when you said that. I would never. I'm slowly drinking Celsius, by the way. It's non-alcoholic, but only because it's 1:48 here. And at least it's like definitely after work drink time where you are.
Yeah, no, it's okay. We understand. Sometimes we like will try and tell guests to drink early, and then we just...
Yeah, really, really peer pressuring them to do drugs. That's honestly, who doesn't want that from a podcast host?
Okay, really quick, for anyone who's across you in the way of like knowing your name, kind of abstractly, maybe reading Natalie's piece in 2019 and then kind of reading like the headlines about the workshop, can you just sum up like in a chaotic timeline in like 2 minutes your life?
Okay. I've been on the internet for 10 years. For the first 5 years, I was a fairy tale. I wrote these captions about my life at Cambridge as this American undergrad, this old British university. And I also developed a debilitating meth addiction while there. Legal meth. Actually, it's fully illegal in the UK. It's just as illegal as meth. But amphetamines were my drug of choice. And by my senior year, I found out that I needed tuition money. Basically, my dad was in a lot of debt, and I couldn't stay at Cambridge unless I came up with $40,000. So I hired my friend, who I loved dearly and thought loved me in return, to help me co-write 50% her words, 50% mine, co-write this document that only publishers saw. And we ended up, because I needed the money so badly, we ended up selling the most profitable version of my life. And I've had a long time to think about this, and I always think I would have sold that book had there been Adderall or no Adderall addiction. But I don't think I would have exited that book deal quite so gracelessly and immaturely had I not been high as fucking balls that year and the year afterward. I basically just told my publishers every day for 2 years that tomorrow I would turn in a book that I had no intention of writing. Finally, I don't know if you've ever done this in a relationship where you like behave so badly instead of just leaving that eventually you yourself are left. Basically, I just did that but in a professional way, which was like even more inappropriate than doing it in your romantic private life. So I'm left by my publishers. Finally, I get help for the Adderall addiction. Fast forward a year and a half, which is how long it takes me to get like fully sober and like work with therapists and AA. I launch creativity workshops. These are launched fully on my Instagram stories. I don't post on my grid at all. All the posts planning these are self-deleting. The events change a lot over the 6 weeks because I'm a chaotic girly and chaos is the brand. The day that the workshops, or the weekend that the workshops happen, unfortunately, is the weekend that the two Fyre Festival documentaries are released. And this one Redditor from Scotland made this super compelling Twitter thread comparing what I had promised in, like, in my first stories with the day of, while leaving out all the stories that I posted and self-deleted, describing how the events would change, asking if people want refunds. And do you know who retweeted this Twitter thread? Jonah fucking Hill, who is now getting his come up.
A fucking menace.
Oh my God.
He's a menace.
Karma will
took a long time for him to get it.
Yeah. It took a while for Natalie to get it too, because after Jonah Hill retweets this Twitter thread, it gets picked up by journalists, and this headline of, like, this influencer is a one-woman Fyre Festival just catches internet fire, no pun intended, with the two Fyre Festival documentaries. Meanwhile, in LA, that girl I hired to co-write the book proposal, she pitches New York Magazine, a scathing tell-all, where she not only says that she did, like, all the work on the book proposal, but really implies that she had built my brand for me and written all my captions about Cambridge that I had written alone without her, mainly because before I even started at Cambridge, I had bought 40,000 fake followers. And in addition to exposing that fact, she really tried to position these one-liner jokes that we wrote for an audience of no one, literal robots, as, like, implying that she continued doing that during the Cambridge years and therefore was, like, the real brains behind the whole Cambridge brand, and that I was just a silly, frivolous, evil, pretty girl. And she sells this piece. It comes out. And when the creativity workshop scandal had happened, I had really tried to fight it. Like, I tried apologizing. I canceled the tour. I gave everyone refunds, even though I thought I was providing, like, a really niche experience for a niche demographic. Like, yeah, there are lots of people who, like, would never pay $165 to, like, spend 6 hours with me and like have lunch and wine and cookies and coffee and goodie bags. But, like, there are lots of people who would pay that and think that's, like, a fair price. And I should have just been like, fuck you to everyone. But instead I apologized. I tried to make it stop. So when Natalie's piece came out, I knew what wouldn't work in terms of, like, PR for handling it. So I, as soon as I found out she was writing the article, I started promoting that article nonstop for 10 days until it came out, until people were frothing at the goddamn mouth to read this piece. They were adding the cut to drop this piece. The girlies were feral for it. And it went absolutely viral, and I leaned into it because I knew leaning away from it brought me nothing but suffering the first time around. And my guess was correct. It was the right way to handle it PR-wise. And now my first book, Scammer, just came out to rave reviews, and people don't like Natalie's book. So karma will get you if you – karma will get you. It's coming for Jonah Hill just like it came for Natalie. So that's – that's how I would explain myself. That was probably 6 minutes, but I tried my best.
Yeah, that was great. There's something really, I don't know, I find kind of tragic about the Natalie thing, is that so much, it seems, of what she was consumed with for the time you were friends was this idea of her life being in the shadow of you and your success and feeling like she was being eclipsed by you. But she's, like, written herself into a corner in a way where that's, like, it's like a Shakespearean or, like, a Greek tragedy or something. Like, she's created this reality for herself where that now will be her forever. Like, her name is, like, synonymous with doing that. It's
so bizarre too, because she's, like, when we knew each other, she was beautiful and popular. Like, she was like a gay girl's dream. She was, like, captain of the, like, varsity soccer team, which is, like, that's, you're elected that position by your peers. Like, that's, like, a voting situation. Like, she was charming and charismatic and well-liked by everyone. And she was also, like, super rich. Like, she's from Connecticut, New Haven, where Yale is. I've been to her house several times. It's like this gorgeous old townhouse. I wouldn't call it a mansion, but like I wouldn't, it's not a mansion. Like her little sister went to Brown. She's like a writing Nepo baby. Like her aunt is the editor in chief of O Magazine and like got her all her first jobs. And like her family has all these connections. And like she's just so rich and like well off socially. And it was just really bizarre to me that she felt like she needed to make herself uglier and less charming and like mousier and dowdier just to like be liked as a character. And I just, it's strange. It's like she's written herself into a life that she never had to have.
Yeah, that whole thing as well with the money and the wealth and everything, like the way you're portrayed online, even kind of before her and through her for sure, is like you are the super, super rich one. Like yeah. She's your poor friend who needs to like clean your house and put it on Airbnb because she has no money. And like, I didn't realize until, yeah, reading your book.
Do you have any of those rich friends who like LARPing as like middle class girls? Like
she's like everybody in England.
Yeah, she's literally that girl. Like she like, obviously like, you know, she writes in her cut essay about this time when we went to Amsterdam and I left with the Airbnb keys, classic young 20s, chaotic girls trip stuff. I leave with the Airbnb keys. I don't realize like I think I realized I had the keys, but I thought I wouldn't crash so hard as soon as I got back. And I thought she was going to go home with this guy at a bar. I thought they were feeling each other. And I thought the most helpful thing I could do for her was just get the fuck out of the way and just like, see you tomorrow, have fun. And I fell asleep as soon as I got back. I was really tired. And this was like peak Adderall years. So my sleep cycles were very like, I only slept once every 3 days. And when I did sleep, it was like the sleep of the dead. And I crashed as soon as I got back. And the guy ended up not wanting to fuck her. But instead of getting a hotel room for the night, which I know she had money for, not just because she came from a rich family, but because I personally had just given her $18,000 for like co-writing this book proposal. Like she preferred to just like wander the streets and spend the rest of our friendship making me feel awful about leaving with the keys. And it's just like some people have like a guilt wound where like they need to like accumulate things to make you feel guilty because they just prefer your guilt over your like uncomplicated love. Like instead of taking care of themselves, they'd rather just like blame you and have your guilt be like the expression of, or like the receipt of your love for them. Like they need that proof that guilt provides of making someone feel bad and the power dynamic that guilt also provides. Yeah, it's just very, I don't feel like I feel like I was definitely the addict and parts of that were toxic, but like I definitely, you know, all the things she is mad at me for doing, I did 8 years ago, high as a kite. And all the things I'm mad at her for doing, she's done within the past 6 months to 3 years, stone cold sober. And like, that's how I feel about that.
It's also just like scary, the power of that victim mentality where you do just every single thing in your perception is being geared towards this narrative about who you are. And obviously you can see in her writing about who she is and about who you are. And like, reading your book and getting all this additional context, like the idea that she was constantly victimized because she, I don't know, like I reread the essay and she was saying, you know, Caroline was wearing a baby doll dress and like I was just wearing leggings and boots.
It's like, I didn't dress you, bitch. You chose that outfit. Like, Jesus. Like,
but you're like in the throes of fucking active addiction and she's the one that's victimized because she doesn't like think the bartender thinks she's as pretty as you. Like, it's just yeah.
It's crazy. The Amsterdam story, I can't. Like, I remember reading it in 2019. I remember reading the essay, coming to this with, like, completely fresh eyes, like, fucking the whole world. It was, like, the most read article on The Cut in 2019.
Yeah.
Obviously, thanks to you promoting it for so much. And I remember reading it at the time, and and being like, you know, the Amsterdam story felt like the crux of the whole thing. It felt like this is proof of how shit of a person this woman is. And I was like, oh, I was just like, Jesus fucking Christ. I was like, I would do that to you, Grace. Yeah. You would do that to me.
Last night, why do you think Grace was walking around the streets with cigarettes? Yes. Like, I left with the keys.
If you had locked me out of the house.
Yeah, it's like literally, like, I've sent her on a train, like, so drunk she can't even keep her eyes open. Yeah. And she wakes up in, like, a station so far from her house, like hours away, and she wakes up and she takes herself fucking home like an adult. And then the next day I'm like, oh shit, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have left you like that, like, my bad, that was like irresponsible. And she's just like, no worries, like, I'm an adult. It's so crazy, like, for anyone who's like,
we were adults in downtown Amsterdam, like, find yourself a fucking, like, hostel, like, and if not, like, a 30-year-old in a hostel, I don't know, spend 120 euro to, like, have a nice hotel and get yourself room service. Like, you just got paid 18 grand. Like, make something out of it. Like, just stop. Like, I think that I take full accountability for all the ways that I was a shitty friend, and it was irresponsible of me to leave her there with the keys. But, like, I don't think it was fundamentally evil of me. Like, I don't, and I think that at a certain point you have to, like, I take accountability for the things that I did that were shitty. And I just feel like she somehow really, by portraying herself as the victim, really got people, as long as they don't, like, look too closely at the narrative and, like, really break it down, like, wait, what are we mad about here? She did a really good job of making me seem like I never take accountability. Well, somehow, like, actually blaming all of her, like, bad decisions on me. Like, everything from, like, what she wore that day to, like, whether or not the bartender wanted to fuck her to, like, why she was incapable of getting a hotel room in downtown Amsterdam.
Also, I googled it. 2 a.m. in Amsterdam, 8 p.m. in New York City. You have your phone on because you're calling Caroline nonstop. Like, call your parents if you don't have money, which apparently you're saying she did.
I know she did, like, just call, cut her that time.
Yeah, but I'm like, just call a friend. Yeah, phone a friend. Say, I don't know what to do. Caroline's not waking up. They'll be like, why don't you go to a hotel?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Like, her parents would have given her that money, but she just, like, I think she knew that she'd always have this story to hold over my head. And, like, in, we were still friends or, like, in contact after Amsterdam for, like, another year and a half before the book deal really blew up. And I cannot tell you how much Amsterdam, like, just she would say the word Amsterdam and I know exactly what she was implying and what she was talking about. And it was always at, like, the center of every fight that we ever had, like, Amsterdam, Amsterdam, Amsterdam. Like, I think in a strange way, she, like, knew subconsciously that, like, the more horrific she made that night for herself, the more power she'd have over me.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah. I think the essay struck such a nerve for people as well, because, and this is something Izzy and I talk about a lot, like, there isn't that, for how big of a deal female friendship is in our lives as women, there isn't that much, like, well-written literature that, like, delves into it as a subject. And I think people were so excited to see that dynamic reflected in, like, you know, a good piece of writing, like, not the best piece of writing ever, but, like, a strong thing. I think that was very exciting for people. And I think it opened the floodgates for a lot of people to think about or have conversations or articulate things in their own relationships they'd had before that they hadn't had the tools to talk about.
Grace, that is so smart. And I totally agree. And I've talked about this so much in the past, and you hit the nail right on the fucking head. I really think it's just the patriarchy keeping women from the gatekeepers of movies, books, plays, like TV shows, just are mainly men in positions of power. And they just don't like seeing stories that don't center male characters at all. Like, stories about female friendship inherently just, like, don't have male main characters. And I really think that the patriarchy has done women a deep fucking disservice. I mean, don't get me started. This isn't my number one complaint. I would start with, like, bodily harm and domestic violence and rape. But on that list of deep disservices that the patriarchy has done to women is definitely preventing these stories that don't center male characters. It's kept them from being told. And I totally just 100% agree with you.
And it's like the way they downplay, the way everything is downplayed for women as being silly. So it's like us having conversations about like the nuances of friendship, being really, really close to another woman in a way that feels like an actual
relationship.
Like you are so close, you're like sisters, you're like partners, but then you don't have that extra level that like means you get through stuff easier, and you don't have like you don't have any context around it to understand what's going on. And then if you talk about it, or like any way it's ever portrayed on screen, is that it's like silliness, it's bitchiness, it's mean girls, and so we don't even know what we're feeling. And then so often like it just doesn't get spoken about, and I think that's why it hits such a chord in a way.
You know what's so funny to me, and which always makes me laugh so hard, is in the years since, I've obviously come across people who are like, you and Natalie remind me so much of me and my friend, or like this one friend that I had. And then they will describe a situation that is like not similar to us at all, like not even a little bit. Like when someone's like, oh my God, like I totally relate to like what you went through with Natalie. I'm like, oh, like was one of you like a addict and like the other one like sold the story of your friendship to like New York fucking magazine? Like, please do tell. But I don't blame the women at all for relating that. I blame the patriarchy for not giving women more stories to choose from to like feel like represented. Like people relate to that story, which is, I promise you, you have not gone through. Like I promise you, whatever you think you like, that story didn't even really happen in real life. Like, cause Natalie lied by omission so heavily. And also until your best friend is telling that story, like is receiving thousands of dollars to like tell your life story for you. Like it's really not a situation like us, but I just, yeah, it's crazy that there is so few examples of stories about female friendship and how it's so like, when you break up with someone, it's hard, but at least you go into every romantic relationship thinking, okay, either we'll be together forever or we'll break up. But you go into every female friendship thinking we're going to be together for forever. And so whenever a female friendship isn't forever and you do break up, it somehow feels like this profound and utter heartbreak that is even deeper than a romantic one, because you never thought it would end. And yeah, we need to give women more stories about that pain, because it is laughable to me and honestly a little sad for me that so many people think that like are forced to relate to me and Natalie because they don't have more stories to choose something closer to their life to relate to.
Yeah. I think what Natalie did was really morally wrong, but I have sympathy for her in some ways, I think, because like just the fact that she knew the one thing that would actually get her published in a magazine that she wanted to be published in, and the actual thing that would get her as close to goals she had as quickly as she could, was throwing another young woman under the bus publicly. Like the fact that she had that instinct and it proved to be completely correct, I think that's very sad. It's a sad reflection on our society, and it doesn't justify doing it, but I just, it does make me feel sad.
Well, what we were talking about, Grace, was like just before, what people I think are relating to when they're talking about your story is the story Natalie told, which is like where your addiction was like, you know, not included. It was like before all that stuff went viral, and what they're relating to is like Natalie's version of it.
Yes.
Of feeling insecure towards another woman
who has it all and you think you're
the lesser cool friend, the less pretty friend, like la la la. And then that competition element that gets brought into it. And like, it's, I think that is such a common part of female, like women friendships, that is very hard to discuss and explore and explain, because you feel so bad if you feel jealous of your friend. Like you feel like such a shit human if you see an Instagram post of theirs and you like, I don't know, think shit of it. But then we're pitted against each other constantly, so it's like obviously that's going to happen.
That's such a good point, and you know, I never thought of that, and I really agree with that. And about it being really sad that she threw me under the bus and did get ahead, like for a couple of years there, like people really gave her lots of praise and money for doing that. But I find it real, and I agreed with you for a while. I was like, how is she allowed to, like, how, I know life isn't fair, but like, this feels really unfair in terms of like her winning and just like the people who like hurt others to get ahead, like coming out on top. But I really do feel like not just with like the difference in how our books have been reviewed, I also just think looking ahead even more long term, I think her punishment is like exactly fair. Like, she did it to like get ahead, and she did get ahead, and she did get paid, but now she'll never be able to escape My Name. Like, all of, even the, you know, like her, the few articles that have been written about her new book, like, they all include my first and last name in the headline. Some of them even include like cover photos of me to like promote it. Like, a lot of them like talk about my book in equal measure. And I think the punishment really fits the crime. You know, like, I couldn't write a better, you said something earlier about like a Greek tragedy. Like, I couldn't, if I were writing like a fairy tale punishment for like what this, if you do someone wrong like this, like, what is the curse that you'll be left with? It would be that you'll never be able to like escape their name, having thought that you could like throw them under the bus to get ahead. It's like, and now this will stay with you forever, and you'll always be forced to be defined by that moment.
It's also like, just write a thinly veiled novel where people are like, maybe it's about Caroline Calloway. We don't know.
We don't, like, know. Yeah.
That's still just a novel. Like, fucking hell.
Yeah. You won't have to use me and my name and my face to like promote your stuff. You won't be attached to it. You won't harm me. You won't make me
feel terrible. People will speculate. Like, yeah. That'll make its own gossip and press.
I also feel like if she wants to be a memoir so bad, it's like, bitch, get your own fucking life, you know? Like, let me write about mine. Like, I'm sorry, like, if you want to be a memoir so fucking bad, like, stop writing about me, you know? But have you guys ever had any friend breakups that really affected you deeply?
I had one kind of recently.
Oh my god.
Well, not recently, in like 2020.
Okay.
And, but it's a really, I think with friendship breakups, it's so hard because so often so much goes unsaid. And it's like reading Natalie's essay, me and Grace were just talking about this, reading Natalie's essay, her version of events is so different to your version of events in your friendship. Like, everything you guys were taking from each other was like, so she thought completely differently to the way you thought about your friendship. Like, she thought you didn't even like her. You were using her. You say in your book, you were like actually in love with her.
Yeah.
Like, it's also, and I think that's the hard part with like sisters and with boyfriends. You scream it out. You scream at each other. You tell them everything. They fucking know what's going on because you're like forced to do that. And with friendships, like, yeah, my friendship with my friend just ended because I felt like she was a shitty friend when I was going through a rough time. She thought I was like quite heavily depressed, so I was being quite crazy, but like she just thought I was being crazy and just kind of, we just cut each other off. And it's like she still never knows to this day what I was going through at that time, which if she did know, she would understand why I was like needing extra support at the time. Like, we just have never talked again, and she would have been like a bridesmaid at my wedding should I ever have one.
Yeah, that's so rough. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's just crazy, isn't it?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Had you ever told her how you felt, or was writing it in Scammer the first time she would have read that?
You know, I really wonder to what extent Natalie really believes what she wrote in her cut essay, because like, I know that some of the things that she wrote about were like purposeful decisions that she knew was not the truth. Like in real life, she was helping me find therapists who specialized in addiction because like, the Adderall problem was like finally really getting out of control. And like, she was worried about me and concerned about me. And like, for example, even when she told me, that she was writing about, she said our friendship, but really sometimes I feel like she should have just said, I'm writing an article called I Was Caroline Calloway. I'm writing about you for the cut, but that's small potatoes. That's not the hill I'm going to die on. But when she emailed me 10 days before when I started on that promotion and said, I'll be writing about our friendship for the cut. She talks about my addiction and my recovery. She uses those exact words. And the email was 3 paragraphs long. And then, you know, in her 5,000 word essay, she doesn't use the word addiction or recovery once. And, you know, she makes my Adderall usage sound just like the cocktails I'm drinking in that essay. Oh, I'm having a beer in this scene. I'm taking an Adderall in this scene. Like, it's really not presented as a disease. Whereas, like, I know both from my experience at the time of those memories that we were living through and her helping me find those addiction specialists to up until 10 days before the essay was published, I know the way that we related behind the scenes was not the way that she wrote about in her essay. Or even another great example is as part of my, like, I never went to AA meetings, but I worked with 3 different therapists 3 days a week for like 18 months who specialized in like AA based addiction treatment. And one of the steps from AA that I did end up doing was, I think it's step 10, but I could have the number right because I didn't do them in order, but it's the step where you make amends. And you make a cataloged list of every way that you ever hurt someone. And I sent Natalie this long, this is like a year and a half before her cut essay. We haven't spoken for a year and a half, but like her essay is a year and a half off. And the creativity workshops haven't happened yet. She doesn't know that someday she'll have a chance to like, my reputation is still as a fairy tale at this point. And I sent her this bulleted long email of apologizing for Amsterdam, among many other things that I did, even just things like failing to like ask her how her day was for like months at a time, because I was just really in my own shit. And I also offered to be friends again because I still really loved her, and I loved a version of her that may never have existed, but I definitely loved that person for sure. Offered to be friends again. And she said, no, I don't want to be friends. And I don't accept your apology, which is fine. That's like part of the AA making amends things. Like if people don't want to give you a chance to change, or even if they don't accept the apology, like this isn't about closure for you. It's about giving the people that you harmed closure and offering and doing something for them, not doing something for yourself. So whatever, I dropped it. We never contacted each other again until she emailed me about the cut essay. But in her cut essay, she's very careful to say, the last time I saw Caroline, she was like 2 hours late and gave me used Glossier makeup and a check that bounced. And then she goes from that scene to present day and made it seem like the last time we saw each other in person was the last time we spoke. Whereas like if she said like the last time I ever spoke to Caroline or talked to her, it would have to have been, you know, as part of my like AA informed recovery process. And I just, yeah, this is all to say that like I'm having lived through these events and also having like seen the way that she manipulated things that I know she was aware of. Like I know she was aware of the amends things. We talked about it. I know she was aware of the addiction and recovery because she said it to me behind the scenes but wouldn't say it publicly. I just wonder how much she actually even felt those emotions. Like I think she was very she may have definitely felt them, but I wonder what other things she left out, or to what extent she just really manipulated the story to make it seem like the most compelling story of victimhood. Like, I don't necessarily like take her cut essay at face value for the real truth of like what she felt or what she experienced, because I know just judging from like looking at the facts of the thing, how much she purposefully and like very craftily left out.
That was something I found, like we both found disappointing about, I think The Cut published another one of her essays from her new book recently.
Yeah, and they did.
I just thought, like, as I was reading it, I just thought it would have been so remarkable to like have done what she did, sit and meditate on it, grapple it, unpack all of her like thing, and then write an essay about that, a follow-up about actually dealing with the fact that she had this childlike two-dimensional view of herself as the hero and you as the villain, and she's had to actually sit and take time and address that, and now she feels guilt, and she's like, that would have been such an amazingly interesting piece of writing, I think. And I was kind of just shocked and surprised that she was talking about You Again, but not in that context of a nuanced, I don't know, it's like been all these years now and her thinking seems to just not really change.
That would have been a better essay, but personally I'm really glad that she returned to her original narrative of like Caroline equals evil, bad, dumb, me equal smart, put upon, victimized, because I always felt like, you know, the Washington Post called Natalie's writing, specifically in The Cut, the original Cut piece, quote, good enough. And I really agree with that. Like, I think that my 10 days of nonstop promotion was really 90% of why that article went viral. But I never could have done it if her writing hadn't been good enough. And so I really am glad that she returned to the same storyline in the same publication, with the same subject, with the same angle, with the same, even like the same photos of us from the same day. And I was really glad that I got to have sort of like, what's it called when scientists have like a trial, or like the test where they like don't do anything to it and they see like how that
the placebo, yeah.
Is the experiment. I'm glad that I got to see what would happen to one of her Cut essays with all the variables the same as before. And the only thing that's changed is that I don't mention it at all on my social media. I don't breathe a word of it. And it was so satisfying to see that essay flop and like not go viral and like not get picked up at all. Like, and I'm just glad for the sake of the scientist in me always thinking that like I had a big part in that virality of that piece. I feel very vindicated that she did return with the exact same storyline, the exact same everything. So that's the only reason that I'm glad that she did that, because I feel like it was the proof I needed that my theory was correct.
Yeah, for sure. And we've talked about her a lot, and I find the ins and outs of your friendship so interesting, which I guess both of us, Grace, and I guess like every woman who feels the same, is like grappling with why exactly. And I think it's what we were talking about before. But aside from her, like, your book is really very incredible. Like, there's so many, most of it isn't even about her. And I think both of us were like really surprised and blown away by how much of an incredible businesswoman you are and and always have been. Like, no fucking shit, dude, to like go on Instagram in 2012, know to buy followers, know to go on stan accounts of literature geeks. The Fault in Our Stars was super popular.
Yeah.
The Hunger Games, Harry Potter, Twilight.
Yeah.
Contact owners of those accounts before you could even DM on Instagram and offer to pay them money to promote your posts, and then copy their captions down to the T so that it sounded like it wasn't a sponsored post. That is like, you should be working at fucking Meta. It's crazy.
I don't know what Meta is, but that sounds...
Meta, sorry. Facebook.
Oh my God. I literally, with your accent, I thought you were saying MITTE, like Meta, yeah, like a German word. You're saying Meta. Yeah, Meta for sure. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for translating your accent for me. Also, Grace, how are you doing with your hangover?
I'm okay. I think the worst has passed. I think. We'll see.
Are you gonna start smoking again? I'm so jealous. I wish I had a cocktail right now.
I don't know. I do like to smoke. That's for sure.
That's clear. That's for sure. No one's doubting that.
But it's, I did honestly just start feeling really physically ill. I smoked for quite a long time and then I started getting like kind of asthmatic, and like my boyfriend said I would just cough all through the night. Like,
you would cough all the time.
Yeah, I could. Yeah,
you were, I used to, you cough were like all wheezing. She was wheezing. She would also, she was such a fucking addict. She was like Lily Rose Depp when she left the Idol fucking thing in France the other day, where she walks out of the after party, lights a cigarette, smokes it twice, throws it on the ground, and gets in a cab. That was Grace. We would walk from like out of her house to the bus stop, and she'd light a cigarette, puff it as fast as she could, and then we'd get on the bus, and she'd throw it in the trash and get on the bus. And it's obviously chic and sexy, but she was dying.
Okay, that is the plot of all of my favorite books, unfortunately. It was obviously chic and sexy, comma, but she was dying.
She was dying.
Unfortunately, I would definitely buy the memoir about your smoking years, unfortunately. But that being said, I really, yeah, you should continue. I hear smoking gives you cancer. If the rumors are true.
The room, there, yeah. Smoking's got bad press over the last 2 years, and it's
yeah, I think
when you're young, you feel like the idea that something will like give you cancer is very abstract, like you can't totally see the journey, whereas I just hit a point where I was like, I can quite physically feel this.
Are you guys look so young? Are you guys in your 20s?
We're 30.
Grace is 29. I'm 32.
I'm 31. Did you have a midlife crisis or like a third life crisis when you turned 30?
I had it. I basically had it when I was 29, because that's when I broke up with my boyfriend of like 6 years. And so that was...
Are you okay? Was this when you were depressed and you went through the friend breakup?
That was when I was depressed and went through the friend breakup.
Okay, it's all coming together for me now.
We'd just moved to London, and it was a rough time. Grace was there through the thick of the thin of it. And it wasn't Adderall, but it was intense, and I feel for her like still to this day of how fucking like
it was awful.
I was like a mess, and we're on the other side of the world, no family. Like, I was literally calling her and texting her at like all hours of the day. She was in Paris on New Year's Eve, and I was at her house alone, and she was like on literal suicide watch. Remember,
I had invited her to Paris just to clear my name. Yeah,
yeah. I was like, Grace, I'm not going to commit suicide. Okay, I've ordered pizza. I'm watching a movie. I'm okay.
She was like, she was such a good friend. She left me alone on New Year's Eve.
No. You were trying to make me come to Paris, but and I was like, go. I lied to you and said I was hanging out with friends. But anyway,
it was winter. It was like the depths of our first winter in London. And it was literally just before COVID. So like Izzy was fucking trying to move into share houses. The press was all about this pandemic, trying to figure out which country to be. It was the most fucking chaotic thing ever.
That was when I had the midlife crisis, because you think you have this life with someone and you're going into 30, and you know, 30, everyone puts all these expectations on women about everything. And then I went through this breakup and I was like, oh, I'm just single, which is fine. But people were being like, it's fine, you're single. Someone got me a book of like how to be single, and it was the worst book I've ever seen. And I was like, I'm gonna die an old maid.
Yeah, that is, oh, it's so much. Wow, that is, I'm so sorry. That really reminds me of when like, just the back-to-back cannot catch a break. It's giving your ex-best friend just sold you out to the cop, and 2 days later your father's rotting body is found. Like, it's very much...
No, Caroline, much worse.
Like, just back-to-back one-two punch. This girl cannot catch a fucking break sort of vibe. I am so sorry. But on a happier note, Grace, I love so much when she was talking about like how miserable she must have been. You literally like roll the tape, play it back. You were literally like, no, you were going through so much. And, you know, I hope you get a chance someday to tell that girl who would have been a bridesmaid what you were going through, because I just think that doing so will reveal her true character to you and how much she ever really loved you and how much your friendship was ever really about caring for the other person. Because, you know, like, yeah, I was terrible during my addiction. And yeah, like, I was a self-obsessed little meth head for like a solid 2 to 3 years. But like, my best friends, like even like the people who I like thanked first in the acknowledgement, who like edited, my number one editor on the book was like a friend from Cambridge. And like, my best friends to this day were like with me during those years and like did not leave me because I was going through a hard time. Like, they all understood that I like very much had a pill problem and that they were like just worried about me. And like, you know, I think it's really easy to, you know, want a guy or a girl who doesn't want you back. I'm not saying that I've never wanted someone who doesn't want me, but I also have never, it's never failed to amaze me the like serenity and just closure that comes from realizing that's like, you know, it was never going to work if that person didn't really love you. Like, what Grace just did is the correct response. Like, there actually is a correct response, and it is, no, I was really worried about you. You were going through a really hard time, even though you do feel guilt about how you acted. And like, all of my real friends to this day, like, they were just worried about me, and they don't hold it against me. And like, I just hope you get a chance to tell that girl what you were really going through, because it will just be so revealing of like what was ever meant to be. Because if she doesn't know, she never got a chance to like know. And that's sad, because, you know, maybe she really does love you and she would understand. But if she doesn't, ugh, good riddance. Like, I'm sorry, she was never meant to be a bridesmaid at your wedding. If she's like, no, but what about me? Like, that is like not okay.
The abstract wedding as well.
The abstract wedding. The Schrodinger's wedding of it all. If you were to get married, do you guys want to get married and have kids?
I'm getting married next year, and I'm really freaking out about it. I'm having my freak out turning 30, getting like all life is all just feeling a bit too adult and too real and too serious at the moment.
It's all a bit much.
I don't feel however I thought I would feel at the point where you're making decisions which seem to have like just quite serious longer term ramifications.
You're incredibly logical and like in a way that most people should be. Like, you're like, I'm in love, but marriage is forever and crazy and random. Like, it all, the way you think makes complete sense, because it's just like, why are we having this like old school ceremony where we're spending all this money to have like this weird kind of little event and everyone gets divorced? Like, you think very logically, and I think it's good to think so much about something like this, because so many people just don't.
The thing that is in my head that tortures me, that I keep bringing up all the time, is like, and this was so funny because I was talking to Zach about this the other night, I was like, the thing is, if we get married, then like, give or take, we kind of are committing to knowing what we're going to be doing every day between now and when we die. And he was like, you fucking wish that was true. Like, he was like, I promise that, like, that, yeah, like, that's a crazy.
Grace, you're insane. I'm sorry. When Caroline Calloway is like, bitch, you crazy. That's unhinged thinking. Like, you know, you got to reel it in. Like, I'm sorry. That's too crazy.
The anxiety is anxiety.
The anxiety is just like full bolt out the gate. She's running.
Medication, girly. Like, I also have anxiety, but like, I found medication. I'm on gabapentin. I don't know if you've ever had a pill problem, but you should not take anything in the benzodiazepine family because they're pretty addictive. But your doctor will give you gabapentin if you express to him these crazy intrusive thoughts you're having.
Insanely.
Get on the pills.
Yeah, I probably should. It's funny because I saw like a psych and got diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder like 5 or 6 years ago. Gad girlies.
Slay.
She gave me so many like helpful tools that like really flipped how I felt in a date. I remember just having this like eureka moment where I felt like I was back in the, it was literally like a ground control to Major Tom. I was like, oh my God, I'm back in the driver's seat of my brain. again.
Oh my god, amazing. Wait, what are the tools? Do you remember them? Tell me now.
Grace is so good with therapy as well. Like, the therapist will be like, you need to do this, this, and this. And Grace will go away and do it.
No.
And then so she'll go back to therapy the next week and then like, she'll learn next? More.
Yeah.
And then within like 6 weeks, she doesn't need to see a therapist anymore because of anxiety. And my therapist would like, I saw the same one and she'd give me this card and I'd like fucking burn it the minute I walked outside. Yeah. I would never look at it. Think about.
That's me.
She was teaching me the tools.
Sometimes my therapist will flat out be like, drink less. And I'll be like, no.
What else?
Like I'll do anything to like stop my anxiety, but that. What are the other options? Like,
yeah.
You know, like there aren't other options.
Like, well, the things to help it are so boring and so like unsexy and unfun and uninteresting.
What are they? Are you about to tell me to drink more water and exercise?
No. It's like cognitive behavioral therapy stuff, which sounds really like banal and stupid, but like over time it really works. And it's basically just, your brain is running with a lot of narratives 24/7. And what anxiety does is it prioritizes the most negative narrative of any given situation. So your brain is like interpreting everything that comes in the most like disaster prone, worst case scenario way.
An example is, we're going to get married and then I'm going to wake up in the same clothes doing the same thing.
Yeah, every day till I'm dead. Life. Yeah.
Character in The Simpsons, like, no, that's, yeah. What you're saying is not gonna happen.
I know. But basically it's that idea of like tools to like catch a thought early and bring in alternative narratives. That was the biggest thing that helped for me, is if I'm like starting to run it, like run away with something, bring in, but what about like a big one we used to do was like, but what if the opposite? It probably sounds like quite obvious, but like, but what if
this whole thing, and then it just sucks.
Takes all the tension out of your brain and your brain stops being in panic mode, because, and that's why this has caught me so off guard, because I felt like so past anxiety in this way that I didn't even recognize what was happening to me was like major anxiety, because it had just gone so far so quickly. And the thing is, when your brain is thinking that, like when I'm in my head being like, I have to do this, I have to get married because it's too late to not do it now. And it also means knowing what I'm going to be doing every day until I die. Like your body is in like panic, chaos, crisis mode 24/7. Like you're so on edge. So then everything else that you're doing feels so unmanageable and so like terrifying. And yeah, it sucks.
You know, I think you should really consider medication.
Drugs.
Yeah.
I think yeah. You should really consider a lobotomy, so because these problems are
electric shock therapy.
Yeah, it's too late for you. Just, yeah. You know, go gently into that dark night. Like there's nothing to be done. Just straight up lobotomy.
Yeah.
But I was on medication, and when my dad died, I went up on medication because I was also dealing with like the public shaming of like Natalie's article and his suicide. And then I came back down on medication, like in terms of antidepressants. And I think it just really, I think people should be more okay. And some people like get on antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds just to like get them through like postpartum and then never take them again. Like, I think that we should be way, I don't know why it isn't more obvious that like certain chapters of your life are more stressful than others and therefore require like more serious measures than other chapters of your life. Like, shouldn't this be like, it's strange because even for me, like I was like, take more antidepressants. Like, does this mean I'm failing at therapy? Like I'm not doing a good job? And it's like, no, calm down, you weird little, like whatever weird taboo you're bringing to this situation, stop it. Stop it. You're being even crazier. Like, yeah, just sometimes some seasons are really fucking stressful. And like, you need to go up. And like, when that season ends, you can go back down, you know?
Yeah. Like, I cannot believe I was not medicated.
I can't believe you weren't.
I also can't believe that. Like, even the small
it's
amount
insane.
That I know.
Like now that I'm looking back, I'm just like, it is fucking crazy.
Crazy. You absolutely just raw dog that depression when you just had to. Raw dogging, bare backing that depression. And yeah. I wish that you hadn't.
I was literally like, okay, I'm not going to kill myself. But then I was looking at parks near Grace's house so that I wouldn't have to do it in her house so she wouldn't find me. But then I was like, she'll feel too guilty because she's away in Paris, so I can't do it now. Like, what? Just get on antidepressants, you fucking crazy bitch.
I literally had that thought as well when I was staying at my boyfriend's house in Seattle. Like, I even found this, like, forest because I didn't even want to go to a park near their house because I was like, then they'll never be able to go to that park again. And, like, maybe they have nice family memories there because this park is close to them. I need to go like an hour away in an Uber, like sort of vibe.
Oh my God. The empathy of women literally knows no bounds. It's like insane. Yeah. How do I kill myself in the nicest, most like,
in the way that's like takes up the least amount of emotional labor for others possible?
Yeah. I don't want to ruin anyone's day.
Yeah, like, I don't want to be inconvenient for anyone. Like, I just, like, don't want to be, like, their problem. Like, while I'm, like, bleh. Yeah, that's actually so crazy. But I love the idea of thinking through better case scenarios. That is really, really helpful.
Wait, do you want to get married and have kids?
No, I don't think. I think I will get married twice. And I think I'll end up with sort of, like, a ward. If that makes sense.
No, I think I will get married twice. That took a second to get through my brain.
No. That's not even the weirder part. I think I'll have a ward, like a Victorian ward someday. I don't think I'll have a child, but I think I will have like someone to look after. Like it, maybe in like a kooky aunt way where I'm like really close with them, or like a godmother way, or like maybe, I don't know. Maybe
have you seen that movie Gloria?
No.
Oh, it's so good. It's this John Cassavetes movie, and it's Gina Rowlands, and she's just like this fabulous chic Upper East Side New Yorker, and her neighbors get like killed by the mob, and she just has to look after their son.
Yeah, I think something like that would happen. Like, it's that vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe I'll end up with a woman, and like she'll want to do like IVF, and she'll get pregnant, but like I'm never carrying a baby in my body, 100%. Like,
me neither.
No
absolutely
way.
Absolutely not.
No, absolutely not. Or maybe I'll become like Kardashian rich and have a surrogate, like, and have a baby that way. But I definitely won't have a child myself. And I've always thought that I'd get married once, then divorced, and then the second marriage would stick. I don't know. I just always thought that.
You're very good with your premonitions.
Yeah.
I don't think I shouldn't be a mom because I'd be a bad mom. I think I shouldn't be a mom because I'll be a crazy mom and I will stare at my kid all day, every day. All I'll do is talk about my kid. My sex life with my like partner will absolutely die. I will never fucking touch them. I will like be a monster because I can't sleep less than 8.5 hours a night. And like, I will have no friends because I won't leave the house. It will just be... I'm staring at, I keep looking to the side because I'm staring at the cat.
Yeah.
Like, imagine if I had a baby.
How did you get your cat from LA to London? Or did the cat stay in London when you went to LA?
The cat stayed in London. It's
this is probably why you're going so crazy for the cat, because you're so happy to see it. But yeah, I totally agree. And on top of that, I'm also worried about like how much women are expected to do as moms versus like what dads are expected to do as dads. And even if you have a really supportive male partner, I just like, I worry that I would never, if I had to choose, not if I had to, I am choosing between a life of books and a life of like married with a partner. And, sorry, someone just sent me a photo of Scammer at the Yale University campus, which I definitely will be posting on my Instagram as soon as we hang up. But very on brand for me, and I love that. But yeah, I wish I could have it all, but if I can't, I just want to make books. Do you guys have any artistic like dreams?
Yes.
Yes, tell me them.
That
question, I hate how I phrased that. Like, do you guys, it made it sound like I thought you didn't. If you had different dreams, I just wanted to make space for you to share that as well. Like, what are your big dreams is how I should have phrased that.
I just wanted to say really quickly before we go on to that is that I will send you a link to this interview Zadie Smith did with Gentlewoman. And she talks about this thing of, there is no role models for women who love literature of like how to be a writer and have children. It's either like Charles Dickens, who had 10 children, but obviously never saw them, or like a Virginia Woolf who sacrificed, like, name whoever, everything. Sacrificed having, like, a traditional family for her books. And, like, this quote, Zadie Smith talking about it literally made me cry, because she said, like, she was like, I just reject that idea so much. And I have decided to take on this thing with my children where, like, I have very clear delineations of time with them, and they can feel that I pull away from them to pursue my art. But I'm okay with that. I actually think that's a great thing for them as humans to learn. And she just said, like, the love that it has given her has, like, deepened and improved her art in these ways she couldn't have imagined. So it's not like, I loved reading that, because I feel like for so long I've had this binary in my head of, like, you either become a great artist or a great writer or you thing.
As soon as I post this Scammer Yale crossover pick, I'm running, not walking, to read that Zadie Smith gentlewoman profile. That's so great and so true. There really are no examples, and it's so hard to try to, like, be something without a single fucking role model, like, where you just, you can't even fucking imagine it in your head.
Yeah,
100%.
Like, at least I had Sylvia Plath and Elizabeth Wurzel and Kat Marnell when I was, like, and Blair Waldorf and, like, lots of other chaotic bougie bitches to, like, pull from, imagining, like, what I wanted the Caroline Calloway brand to encompass. But, like, yeah, there's really no great artist writer moms yet. Maybe Zadie.
I think she might be the first.
Zadie will be the first. Another Cambridge girly for the win. I want that for her and for us.
Exactly. Yeah, what are your artistic dreams, Izzy?
When you said, like, do you have any, and then you felt really bad for saying that, it actually made me think, because I feel like what I've been really bad at doing as I've gotten older is having an actual plan and an idea of what I want for my life. And I think what is so remarkable about you, and it shows how worthwhile it is having a really clear plan in your mind and a really clear idea of who you want to be, because constantly you're working towards that. And I think when I was younger, I was so good at that. I used to write down every single year at high school what I wanted to be doing, who I wanted to be writing for, what my goals were, so detailed. And it all came true. Like, I would look at it and just be like, now I write at this magazine, now I work for that. And then in recent years, it's just become more and more kind of, like, vague things that I want to accomplish.
No, you got to return to that specificity. Like, that is where...
Or even, like, things where it's just, like, things that you want to accomplish, but then you interrogate whether you actually do want to accomplish them, or you just think you do because that's what other writers have done before you, but actually you don't even give a fuck about it, and that's why you're not working towards it subconsciously. I think both of us, me and Grace, recently have just been, like, really trying to sit back and strip away from everything else, all of these outside noises, all of these other people around us who are doing similar jobs and successful at this and successful at that, and be like, what is it that we actually want to achieve? And I think what is so funny about it is I wanted to write a book when I was, like, a kid. And since I've gotten older, I've just been like, no, I don't want to write a book because I have nothing, you know, I have nothing, no good story to say, or like, there's so many other books out there and I don't know if I have, I don't know. I've just really been, like, very self-deprecating about it. And I think it's because I'm, as I said, like, I find the way you just said you wanted to write a book forever so incredible, and I think my thing has been pushing away from it because I'm scared to be vulnerable and scared to, like, show work to people because I'm scared they'll think it's shit. And so I've been like, I don't want to do that. And maybe even that's how I feel, like, that's why I say about, like, marriage and kids, I'm like, I don't want to do that, like, I'm good without it, because it's scary to say that you want that and then to maybe not succeed.
Dude, first of all, can I just say how much I genuinely enjoy you guys? And I really hope that we stay friends after this podcast.
Like,
I think you guys are great people, and like, Grace, Izzy, you are a vibe and a half. And Grace, if you are this great hungover, like, I can't wait to see you pulling a Lily Rose Depp, smoking, like, three cigarettes at once. Oh, the only time that year you will smoke, because it's not a chronic thing, because we hate cancer. But yeah, no, first of all, I just, like, love everything you're saying. It's so relatable. Like, I've talked to my therapist about feeling like I don't have anything to say. And, like, I hope you feel like that's crazy, because you're like, I hope you like the book and that you think, like, there are lots of things that you'd like to know about me. But, like, I would love I think it's crazy to hear you say that you like aren't sure like if you have any stories to tell, because like the time of your depression is so interesting. I would love to have more books about like visiting that dark place internally and finding your way back from it. Like I would love to read that. And I do think it's really good to step back from the rat race and reevaluate your goals. I mean, I definitely got into that big blockbuster book deal my senior year of college. I needed the money, but I also, it didn't hurt that by selling the most mainstream marketable version of myself in order to get the biggest paycheck, it didn't hurt that that big paycheck really did something for my ego and for my pride. And it really made me feel like all the people who didn't believe that my Instagram was worthwhile or that I'd make it as an artist, like I felt like I was proving something to them. And it turned out like selling a book, a memoir that wasn't even about me, that like really didn't, that wasn't even a book that I wanted to write, it meant nothing to me, even with the big paycheck, even with the social validation. And like, it's great to like step back from that and like reevaluate. But if you don't follow up that reevaluation with a new direction to take its place, like you're really not that much better off. You've just gone from going in the wrong direction to like a stasis, like to going in no direction. And like, mm-hmm. I really hope that you don't let yourself like spook yourself into not even trying, because that's so, I just don't think that you're alone in feeling like you have nothing to say, or that you don't want to show people your work, or that it'd be bad. I felt so much pressure. Like do you know how I was haunted by the idea of like finally putting a book out and then people would be like, and this is proof that she is just as dumb and bad of a writer as Natalie always said. And this just further proves that Natalie did make her brand and she was the real brains behind everything. Like that thought haunted my anxiety. And like, it really kept me from trying for like a decade. And I just don't think that you're alone in any of these feelings. Like I've also felt them, and I don't think people would think that I would feel that way. Like, you know, knowing that I did write all the Cambridge captions myself, you could say like, well, didn't you have the proof? Like, even if no one else believed you, like you should know that you got those numbers by yourself and you pulled in those real fans after the 40K fake followers. And like, you should know that the writing would be good, or like, you know, people write articles about you. You should know that like people want to hear about your life. I swear on Matisse's life, the cat for which I would give all 10 of my fingers so that I just have two stumps instead of hands. Like I really dreaded what might happen if it wasn't good enough. And I dreaded with every fiber of my being, like it just not having enough to say. And I just think all those fears are relatable, and I hope you don't let them stop you, because everyone feels that way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's so good to hear you say that.
I know. I've just always wanted to like write screenplays or direct short films or write like just...
Grace is a movie girl.
I'd also love to write a novel. Like I just love creative writing, and I'm in a similar boat to Izzy where I've been very scared to do it for a very long time, but I've had a bit of a revelatory year this year, aided by Rick Rubin's book.
Who the fuck is Rick Rubin?
Okay, I didn't have any idea. My friend bought it for me for my birthday, and he's like the founder of Diff Jam Recordings, this amazing record producer, but his whole thing is about creativity. Like he basically, in Jay-Z's 99 Problems, right? He was the one that made him go, what did it say?
Wait, the great story, Izzy. Amazing.
The bit at the start. This is empty now. And this was two shots. Yeah. It's like, I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one, hit me. And then the beat comes in. That was him.
That is a really good part of the song. I'm sorry I gave you shit about that.
And then he wrote a whole book, and then me and Grace have read it. And it's just basically like a little bit corny, a little bit self-help, but basically being like, remove everything from the creative process and just create.
Yeah.
Back to you, Grace. Please
in our group chat, send me the title of this book. Yes, like, please send that along. Okay, so you want to do a screenplay and a novel, and what about you, Izzy?
Yeah.
A book? Oh, it sounds like a book.
Probably that. Yeah, probably, not screenplay, probably a book at some point.
But would it be a memoir or a novel? I hope it's a memoir, but whatever.
Well, to be honest, I have been working on like a book of essays about growing up in New Zealand in the 2000s and just like different essays about different things, which is, it's basically just stories that I went through. But I don't know, but it's just like, it's nice just working for the, as Grace said, kind of doing it to do it. And even if it goes nowhere, it's so nice writing. Don't you think?
Oh, it's the best feeling ever. Yeah.
Let's say goodbye officially.
The only three things I want from your viewers is that they be their own crappy little elf, that they're not afraid of their anger because it can help push through blocks. And please, in future episodes, help Grace write her screenplay and her novel. And please help Izzy write her books, because now you guys know what their artistic dreams are. And hopefully all your scammer girlies in Australia and elsewhere will rally to the cause. And now they can help you along.
Caroline,
and you'll
we
have
love
me.
You.
You have my number. I love you too. I genuinely had so much fun with you.
Thank you.
Bye, bye, Caroline. Thank you so much. Bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.